The Voice of America presents live coverage of U.S. President Joe Biden's State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress and the Republican response to be delivered by Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. I'm Michael Bowman, VOA National Editor, joined by Chief National Correspondent and former White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Welcome, Steve.
Pleasure to be with you.
At this hour, lawmakers of both parties and both chambers of Congress are gathered in the House of Representatives to receive an annual message from the President, as mandated by the U.S. Constitution. So, Steve, this is a time of genuine crisis abroad and challenges at home. What do you expect to hear from President Biden?
Well, Michael, these annual addresses do not make news every year, but news is going to be made tonight by President Biden. First and foremost, he is expected to announce that the United States airspace is going to be closed to all Russian flights following Canada and the European Union. And of course, a lot of this, much more, will be on foreign policy than domestic policy than is normal because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And shortly, we expect that the Sergeant-at-Arms will announce the arrival of the President to the House chamber. This will be Biden's second speech before Congress as president, but the first State of the Union address, Biden's first speech, considered a message to Congress, was delivered last April, 3 months after he assumed office. Steve, huge swaths of Biden's agenda seem stuck in Congress. The president's approval rating has dropped precipitously. Is this an opportunity for the White House to advance some priorities, including, I might mention, a Supreme Court nominee announced just days ago?
Most certainly that is going to come up, and we're going to hear a lot about the president's agenda, some of it quite stuck at this moment. We're probably also going to hear an uplifting note about the COVID pandemic, and the president will say that we're moving past it and that a plan is going to come out as soon as tomorrow. How the country is going to move beyond COVID. And we're also going to hear a lot about the economy, especially about a big problem for the president, which is inflation in the United States.
Yes, clearly a lot of Americans are feeling the pinch in the wallet. Aside from politicians, attendees at the State of the Union include America's top military brass, Supreme Court justices, members of the president's cabinet, save one, and guests invited by the White House and lawmakers. First of all, Steve, why save one? Why do they hold one cabinet member back? And do we know about any special guests tonight?
Yes, well, that person who is held back is known as the designated survivor in case something unimaginable would happen, that the United States would still have continuity and be able to function. In fact, a relatively underappreciated television series was made about that. So the designated survivor this year, we're told, is Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. I also believe one of the Supreme Court justices will not be attending tonight, Merrick Garland. And we have three members of Congress, at least, that are absent because they have tested positive for COVID. Now, you're right, there are usually a lot of guests, but because of social distancing still in place, although you won't see very many masks tonight, the members of Congress don't have their guests in-house. They'll be virtual guests. But among the guests of the First Lady in her viewing box is a woman named Oksana Makarova, who has rose in prominence in this country in recent days because she is Ukraine's ambassador to the United States.
Wow. Any preview we can give at this point in terms of what we're likely to hear from the Republican side? I know that we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but as is always the case, when one party is allowed to deliver the State of the Union, the other party gets to respond.
Yes, we're going to hear from Governor Kim Reynolds of the Midwestern state of Iowa, relatively unknown figure outside of her state, and she will be delivering the Republican response. What we're going to hear from her is a message contrary to what the White House has been projecting, that the president has been taking the United States forward. She's going to say that Joe Biden has been taking the country back to the 1970s and 80s, perhaps not the best of times in recent American history. especially in terms of the economy.
I believe I see on my monitor the president standing about to enter the chamber.
Madam Speaker, the President of the United States.
And Joe Biden, President Biden, is now inside the House chamber. He is walking down a central aisle, and he's being greeted by members of Congress of both political parties. There's a lot of handshaking going on. One gets the feeling that for President Biden, this is something of a homecoming. I mean, he is very much a creature of Congress, or he was before he became President Obama's vice president.
Michael, there are a lot of these that Joe Biden sat through, not only as a member of the Senate, but also as vice president, because the vice president presides over the Senate in these joint sessions. So he knows what it is like. He's seen the good ones, the bad ones, the in-betweens. And Joe Biden wants to send the ball out of the stadium tonight with this speech. And we may be talking here for quite a bit, because this president is going to shake hands with a lot of familiar faces. And as much as his staff tries to keep him on schedule at events like this, he will definitely bide his time making his way to the lectern. And this is, as you said, really a homecoming for Joe Biden, who I think has wanted to do this for many years, if not decades.
Now, obviously, Republicans oppose the president's agenda. They are critical of him. But there is a tradition that at least when the president enters for the State of the Union, that there is a tremendous ovation and that everybody of both parties is on their feet.
Yes, and so far, in the first opening seconds, it looks very polite and dignified. But you will see opposition politicians in these speeches sit on their hands a lot of the time.
Members of Congress, I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the President of the United States.
And that was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a California Democrat, introducing the president. And now we go through a second round of ovations, as is tradition here.
Right. The president wants to see this start of his speech delayed as much as possible by applause. He's turning around again to look back at Speaker Pelosi.
Thank you, General.
But, yeah, I think he's going to start any second.
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you. Please. Thank you so much. Madam Speaker, Madam Vice President, and our First Lady and Second Gentleman, members of Congress and the Cabinet, Justice of the Supreme Court, my fellow Americans. Last year, COVID-19 kept us apart. This year, we're finally together again. Tonight, tonight, we meet as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, but most importantly, as Americans, with the duty to one another, to America, to the American people, to the Constitution, and an unwavering resolve that freedom will always triumph over tyranny. 6 days ago, Russia's Vladimir Putin sought to shake the very foundations of the free world, thinking he could make it bend to his menacing ways. But he badly miscalculated. He thought he could roll into Ukraine and the world would roll over. Instead, He met with a wall of strength he never anticipated or imagined. He met the Ukrainian people. The President Zelensky, to every Ukrainian, their fearlessness, their courage, their determination literally inspires the world. Groups of citizens blocking tanks with their bodies. Everyone from students to retirees to teachers turned soldiers defending their homeland. And in this struggle, President Zelensky said in his speech to the European Parliament, light will win over darkness. The Ukrainian ambassador to the United States is here tonight, sitting with the First Lady. Let each of us, if you're able to stand, stand and send an unmistakable signal to the world of Ukraine. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. She's bright, she's strong, she's resolved. Yes. We, the United States of America, stand with the Ukrainian people. Throughout our history, we've learned this lesson. When dictators do not pay a price for their aggression, they cause more chaos. They keep moving. And the cost, the threats to America and America to the world keeps rising. That's why the NATO alliance was created, to secure peace and stability in Europe after World War II. The United States is a member, along with 29 other nations. It matters. American diplomacy matters. American resolve matters. Putin's latest attack on Ukraine was premeditated and totally unprovoked. He rejected repeated efforts at diplomacy. He thought the West and NATO wouldn't respond. He thought he could divide us at home, in this chamber, in this nation. He thought he could divide us in Europe as well. But Putin was wrong. We are ready. We are united, and that's what we did. We stayed united. We prepared extensively and carefully. We spent months building coalitions of other freedom-loving nations in Europe and the Americas, from America to the Asian and African continents, to confront Putin. Like many of you, I spent countless hours unifying our European allies. We shared with the world in advance what we knew Putin was planning and precisely how we would try to falsify and justify his aggression. We countered Russia's lies with the truth. And now that he's acted, the free world is holding him accountable, along with 27 members of the European Union, including France, Germany, Italy, as well as countries like the United Kingdom, Canada, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and many others, even Switzerland, are inflicting pain on Russia and supporting the people of Ukraine. Putin is now isolated from the world more than he has ever been. Together, along with our allies, we are right now enforcing powerful economic sanctions. We're cutting off Russia's largest banks in the international financial system, preventing Russia's central bank from defending the Russian ruble, making Putin's $630 billion war fund worthless. We're choking Russia's access. We're choking Russia's access to technology that will sap its economic strength and weaken its military for years to come. Tonight, I say to the Russian oligarchs and the corrupt leaders who bilk billions of dollars off this violent regime, no more. The United States, I mean it. The United States Department of Justice is assembling a dedicated task force to go after the crimes of the Russian oligarchs. We're joining with European allies to find and seize their yachts, their luxury apartments, their private jets. We're coming for you, ill-begotten gains. And tonight, I'm announcing that we will join our allies in closing off American airspace to all Russian flights, further isolating Russia and adding additional squeeze on their economy. He has no idea what's coming. The ruble has already lost 30% of its value. The Russian stock market has lost 40% of its value, and trading remains suspended. The Russian economy is reeling, and Putin alone is the one to blame. Together with our allies, we're providing support to the Ukrainians in their fight for freedom. Military assistance, economic assistance, humanitarian assistance. We're giving more than $1 billion of direct assistance to Ukraine, and will continue to aid the Ukrainian people as they defend their country and help ease their suffering. But let me be clear. Our forces are not engaged and will not engage in the conflict with Russian forces in Ukraine. Our forces are not going to Europe to fight Ukraine, but to defend our NATO allies in the event that Putin decides to keep moving west. For that purpose, we have mobilized American ground forces, air squadrons, ship deployments to protect NATO countries, including Poland, Romania, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. And as I've made crystal clear, the United States and our allies will defend every inch of territory that is NATO territory with the full force of our collective power. Every single inch. And we're clear-eyed. The Ukrainians are fighting back with pure courage. But the next few days, weeks, and months will be hard on them. Putin has unleashed violence and chaos. But while he may make gains on the battlefield, he'll pay a continuing high price over the long run. And a pound of Ukrainian people, the proud, proud people, pound for pound, ready to fight with every inch of energy they have. They've known 30 years of independence, have repeatedly shown that they will not tolerate anyone who tries to take their country backwards. To all Americans, I'll be honest with you, as I always promised I would be. A Russian dictator invading a foreign country has cost around the world. And I'm taking robust action to make sure the pain of our sanctions is targeted at Russian economy and that we use every tool at our disposal to protect American businesses and consumers. Tonight, I can announce the United States has worked with 30 other countries to release 60 million barrels of oil from reserves around the world. America will lead that effort, releasing 30 million barrels of our own strategic petroleum reserve. And we stand ready to do more if necessary, united with our allies. These steps will help blunt gas prices here at home, but I know news about what's happening can seem alarming to all Americans. But I want you to know, we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay. When the history of this era is written, Putin's war in Ukraine will have left Russia weaker and the rest of the world stronger. While it shouldn't have taken something so terrible for people around the world to see what's at stake, now everyone sees it clearly. We see the unity among leaders of nations, a more unified Europe, a more unified West. We see unity among the people who are gathering in cities and large crowds around the world, even in Russia, to demonstrate their support for the people of Ukraine. In the battle between democracy and autocracies, democracies are rising to the moment, and the world is clearly choosing the side of peace and security. This is the real test. And it's going to take time. So let us continue to draw inspiration from the iron will of the Ukrainian people. to our fellow Ukrainian Americans who forged a deep bond that connects our two nations. We stand with you. We stand with you. Putin may circle Kyiv with tanks, but he'll never gain the hearts and souls of the Iranian people. He'll never extinguish their love of freedom, and he will never, never weaken the resolve of the free world. We meet tonight in an America that has lived through two of the hardest years this nation has ever faced. The pandemic has been punishing, and so many families are living paycheck to paycheck, struggling to keep up with the rising cost of food, gas, housing, and so much more. I understand, like many of you did. My dad had to leave his home in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to find work. So like many of you, I grew up in a family when the price of food went up, it was felt throughout the family. It had an impact. That's when one of the first things I did as president was fight to pass the American Rescue Plan. Because people were hurting, we needed to act, and we did. Few pieces of legislation have done more at a critical moment in our history to lift us out of a crisis. It fueled our efforts to vaccinate the nation and combat COVID-19, delivered immediate economic relief to tens of millions of Americans. It helped put food on the table. Remember those long lines of cars waiting for hours just to get a box of food put in their trunk? It cut the cost of health care insurance. And as my dad used to say, it gave the people just a little bit of breathing room. Unlike the $2 trillion tax cut passed in the previous administration that benefited the top 1% of Americans, the American Rescue Plan helped working people and left no one behind. Folks, and it worked. It worked. It worked. We created jobs, lots of jobs. In fact, our economy created over 6.5 million new jobs just last year. More jobs in 1 year than ever before in the history of the United States of America. The economy grew at a rate of 5.7 last year, the strongest growth rate in 40 years, and the first step in bringing fundamental change to our economy that hasn't worked for working people in this nation for too long. For the past 40 years, we were told that tax break for those at the top and benefits would trickle down and everyone would benefit. But that trickle-down theory led to a weaker economic growth, lower wages, bigger deficits, and a widening gap between the top and everyone else in nearly a century. Look, Vice President Harris and I ran for office, and I realize we have fundamental disagreements on this, but ran for office with a new economic vision for America. Invest in America. Educate Americans. Grow the workforce. Build the economy from the bottom up and the middle out, not from the top down, because we know when the middle class grows, the poor have a way up and the wealthy do very well. America used to have the best roads, bridges, and airports on earth, and now our infrastructure is ranked 13th in the world. We won't be able to compete for the jobs of the 21st century if we don't fix it. That's why it was so important to pass the bipartisan infrastructure law. And I thank my Republican friends to join, to invest, and rebuild America, the single biggest investment in history. It was a bipartisan effort, and I want to thank the members of both parties who worked to make it happen. We're done talking about infrastructure weeks. We're now talking about an infrastructure decade. And look, it's going to transform America, to put us on a path to win the economic competition of the 21st century, that we face with the rest of the world, particularly China. I've told Xi Jinping, it's never been a good bet to bet against the American people. We'll create good jobs for millions of Americans, modernizing roads, airports, ports, waterways, all across America. And we'll do it to withstand the devastating effects of climate change and promote environmental justice. We'll build a national network of 500,000 electric vehicle charging stations, begin to replace the poisonous lead pipes so every child, every American has clean water to drink at home and at school. We're going to provide affordable, high-speed internet for every American, rural, suburban, urban, and tribal communities. 4,000 projects have already been announced. Many of you have announced them in your districts. And tonight, I'm announcing that this year, we will start fixing over 65,000 miles of highway and 1,500 bridges in disrepair. And folks, when we use taxpayers' dollars to rebuild America, we're going to do it by buying America. Buy American products. Support American jobs. The federal government spends about $600 billion a year to keep this country safe and secure. There's been a law on the books for almost a century to make sure taxpayers' dollars support American jobs and businesses. Every administration, Democrat and Republican, says they'll do it. But we're actually doing it. We'll buy America to make sure everything from the deck of an aircraft carrier to the steel on highway guardrails is made in America from beginning to end. All of it. All of it. But, folks, to compete for the jobs of the future, we also need a level playing field with China and other competitors. That's why it's so important to pass the Bipartisan Innovation Act sitting in Congress that will make record investments in emerging technologies and American manufacturing. We used to invest almost 2% of our GDP in research and development. We don't now. China is. Let me give you one example why it's so important to pass. If you travel 20 miles east of Columbus, Ohio, you'll find 1,000 empty acres of land. It won't look like much, but if you stop and look closely, you'll see a field of dreams, the ground on which America's future will be built. That's where Intel, the American company that helped build Silicon Valley, is going to build a $20 billion semiconductor megasite. Up to 8 state-of-the-art factories in one place. 10,000 new jobs. And in those factories, the average job about $135,000 a year. Some of the most sophisticated manufacturing in the world to make computer chips the size of a fingertip. The power of the world in everyday lives, from smartphones, technology, the internet, technology is yet to be invented. But that's just the beginning. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger, who is here tonight, I don't know where Pat is. Pat, there you go. Pat, stand up. Pat came to see me, and he told me they're ready to increase their investment from $20 billion to $100 billion. That would be the biggest investment in manufacturing in American history. And all they're waiting for is for you to pass this bill. So let's not wait any longer. Send it to my desk. I'll sign it. And we'll really take off in a big way. And folks, Intel is not alone. There's something happening in America. Just look around and you'll see an amazing story, the rebirth of pride that comes from stamping products made in America, the revitalization of American manufacturing. Companies are choosing to build new factories here when just a few years ago they would have gone overseas. That's what's happening. Ford is investing $11 billion in electric vehicles, creating 11,000 jobs across the country. GM is making the largest investment in its history, $7 billion to build electric vehicles, creating 4,000 jobs in Michigan. All told, 369,000 new manufacturing jobs were created in America last year alone.
You're listening to VOA's live coverage of U.S. President Joe Biden's State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress.
Powered by people I've met like JoJo Burgess, from generations of union steelworkers in Pittsburgh, who's here with us tonight. Where are you, JoJo? There you go. Thanks, buddy. As Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown says, it's time to bury the label Rust Belt. It's time to see the what used to be called the Rust Belt become the home of a significant resurgence of manufacturing. And with all the bright spots in our economy, record job growth, higher wages, too many families are struggling to keep up with their bills. Inflation is robbing them of gains they thought otherwise they would be able to feel. I get it. That's why my top priority is getting prices under control. Look, our economy roared back faster than almost anyone predicted. But the pandemic meant that businesses had a hard time hiring enough people because of the pandemic to keep up production in their factories. So you didn't have people making those beams that went into buildings because they were out. The factory was closed. The panic also disrupted the global supply chain. Factories close. When that happens, it takes longer to make goods and get them to the warehouses, to the stores, and prices go up. Look at cars last year. One-third of all the inflation was because of automobile sales. There weren't enough semiconductors to make all the cars that people wanted to buy. And guess what? Prices of automobiles went way up, especially used vehicles as well. And so we have a choice. One way to fight inflation is to drive down wages and make Americans poorer. I think I have a better idea to fight inflation. Lower your costs, not your wages. Folks, that means make more cars and semiconductors in America, more infrastructure and innovation in America, more goods moving faster and cheaper in America, more jobs where you can earn a good living in America. Instead of relying on foreign supply chains, let's make it in America. Look, economists call this increasing the productive capacity of our economy. I call it building a better America. My plan to fight inflation will lower your costs and lower the deficit. 17 Nobel laureates in economics said my plan will ease long-term inflationary pressures. Top business leaders, and I believe most Americans, support the plan. And here's the plan. First, cut the cost of prescription drugs. We pay more for the same drug produced by the same company in America and any other country in the world. Just look at insulin. 1 in 10 Americans has diabetes. In Virginia, I met a 13-year-old boy, the handsome young man standing up there, Joshua Davis. He and his dad both have type 1 diabetes, which means they need insulin every single day. Insulin costs about $10 a vial to make. That's what it costs the pharmaceutical company. But drug companies charge families like Joshua and his dad up to 30 times that amount. I spoke with Joshua's mom. Imagine what it's like to look at your child who needs insulin to stay healthy and have no idea how in God's name you're going to be able to pay for it. What it does to your family, but what it does to your dignity, your ability to look your child in the eye, to be the parent you expect yourself to be. I really mean to think about that. That's what I think about. You know, yesterday, Joshua's here tonight, but yesterday was his birthday. Happy birthday, buddy, by the way. For Joshua and 200,000 other young people with type 1 diabetes, let's cap the cost of insulin at $35 a month. So everyone can afford it. And drug companies will do very, very well, their profit margin. While we're at it, I know we have great disagreements on this floor with this. Let's let Medicare negotiate the price of prescription drugs. They already set the price for VA drugs. Look, the American Rescue Plan is helping millions of families with Affordable Care Act plans to save them $2,400 a year on their health premiums. Let's close the coverage gap and make these savings permanent. And second, let's cut energy costs for families, an average of $500 a year, by combating climate change. Let's provide an investment tax credit to weatherize your home and your business, to be energy efficient and get a tax credit for it. Double America's clean energy production in solar, wind, and so much more. Lower the price of electric vehicles, saving another $80 a month that you're not going to have to pay at the pump. Folks, the third thing we can do to change the standard of living for hardworking folks is cut the cost of child care. Cut the cost of child care. Folks, if you live in a major city in America, you pay up to $14,000 a year for child care per child. I was a single dad for 5 years, raising two kids. I had a lot of help, though. I had a mom, a dad, a brother, and a sister that really helped. But middle-class and working folks shouldn't have to pay more than 7% of their income to care for the young children. My plan would cut the cost of child care in half for most families and help parents, including millions of women who left the workforce during the pandemic because they couldn't afford child care, to be able to get back to work, generating economic growth. But my plan doesn't stop there. It also includes home and long-term care, more affordable housing, pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds. All these will lower costs for families. And under my plan, nobody, let me say this again, nobody earning less than $400,000 a year will pay an additional penny in new taxes. Not a single penny. I may be wrong, but my guess is if we took a secret ballot in this floor, that we'd all agree that the present tax system ain't fair. We have to fix it. I'm not looking to punish anybody, but let's make corporations and wealthy Americans start paying their fair share. Look, last year, and like Chris Coons and Tom Carper and my distinguished congresswoman, we come from the land of corporate America. There are more corporations incorporated in America than every other state in America combined. And I still won 36 years in a row. The point is, even they understand they should pay just a fair share. Last year, 55 of the Fortune 500 companies earned $40 billion in profit and paid zero in federal taxes. Now, look, it's not fair. That's why I proposed a 15% minimum tax rate for corporations. And that's why in the G7 and other meetings overseas we're able to put together, I was able to be somewhat helpful, 130 countries agree on a global minimum tax rate. So companies can't get out of paying their taxes at home by shipping jobs and factories overseas. It'll raise billions of dollars. That's why I propose closing loopholes for the very wealthy who don't pay, who pay a lower tax rate than a teacher and a firefighter. So that's my plan, but we have to go in more detail later. I'm going to grow, we will grow the economy, lower the cost of families. So what are we waiting for? Let's get this done. We all know we've got to make changes. Folks, and while you're at it, confirm my nominees for the Federal Reserve, which plays a critical role in fighting inflation. My plan will not only lower costs and give families a fair shot, it will lower the deficit. The previous administration not only ballooned the deficit with those tax cuts for the very wealthy and corporations, it undermined the watchdogs, the job of those to keep pandemic relief funds being wasted. Remember we had those debates about whether or not those watchdogs should be able to see every day how much money was being spent, where was it going to the right place? But in my administration, the watchdogs are back. And we're going to go after the criminals who stole billions of relief money meant for small business and millions of Americans. Tonight, I'm announcing that the Justice Department will soon name a chief prosecutor for pandemic fraud. Look, I think we all agree. Thank you. By the end of this year, the deficit will be down to less than half of what it was before I took office. The only president ever to cut the deficit by more than $1 trillion in a single year. Lowering your cost also meant demanding more competition. I'm a capitalist, but capitalism without competition is not capitalism. Capitalism without competition is exploitation. It drives up profits. And corporations have to compete. Their profits go up and your prices go up when they don't have to compete. Small businesses and family farmers and ranchers, I need not tell some of my Republican friends from those states. Guess what? You got four basic meatpacking facilities. That's it. You play with them or you don't get to play at all. And you pay a hell of a lot more. A hell of a lot more because there's only four. See what's happening with ocean carriers moving goods in and out of America. During the pandemic, about half a dozen or less foreign-owned companies raised prices by as much as 1,000% and made record profits. Tonight, I'm announcing a crackdown on those companies overcharging American businesses and consumers. And folks, and as Wall Street firms take over more nursing homes, quality in those homes has gone down, and costs have gone up. That ends on my watch. Medicare is going to set higher standards for nursing homes and make sure your loved ones get the care they deserve and that they inspect and they will look at closely. We're also going to cut costs to keep the economy going strong and giving workers a fair shot, provide more training and apprenticeships, hire them based on skills, not just their degrees. Let's pass the Paycheck Fairness Act and paid leave. Raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. And extend the child tax credit so no one has to raise a family in poverty. Let's increase Pell Grants, increase our historic support for HBCUs, and invest in what Jill, our First Lady who teaches full-time, calls America's best-kept secret, community colleges. Look, let's pass the PRO Act. When a majority of workers want to form a union, they shouldn't be able to be stopped. When we invest in our workers and we build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out together, we can do something we haven't done in a long time, build a better America. For more than 2 years, COVID has impacted every decision in our lives and the life of this nation. And I know you're tired, frustrated, and exhausted. That doesn't even count the close to a million people who sit at a dining room table or a kitchen table and look at an empty chair because they lost somebody. But I also know this. Because of the progress we've made, because of your resilience and the tools that we have been provided by this Congress, tonight I can say we're moving forward safely back to more normal routines. We've reached a new moment in the fight against COVID-19, where severe cases are down to a level not seen since July of last year. Just a few days ago, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention issued a new mask guidelines. Under the new guidelines, most Americans and most of the country can now go mask-free. And based on projections, more of the country will reach across the next couple of weeks. And thanks to the progress we've made in the past year, COVID-19 no longer need control our lives. I know some are talking about living with COVID-19, but tonight I say that we never will just accept living with COVID-19. We'll continue to combat the virus as we do other diseases. And because this virus mutates and spreads, we have to stay on guard. And here are four common sense steps as we move forward safely, in my view. First, stay protected with vaccines and treatments. We know how incredibly effective vaccines are. If you're vaccinated and boosted, you have the highest degree of protection. We'll never give up on vaccinating more Americans. Now, I know parents with kids under 5 are eager to see their vaccines authorized for their children. Scientists are working hard to get that done. We'll be ready with plenty of vaccines if and when they do. We're all ready. We are also ready with antiviral treatments. If you get COVID-19, the Pfizer pill reduces your chances of ending up in the hospital by 90%. I've ordered more pills than anyone in the world has. Pfizer is working overtime to get us 1 million pills this month and more than double that next month. And now we're launching the Test to Treat initiative. So people can get tested at a pharmacy, and if they prove positive, receive the antiviral pills on the spot at no cost. Folks, if you're immunocompromised or have some other vulnerability, we have treatments and free high-quality masks. We're leaving no one behind or ignoring anyone's needs as we move forward. On testing, we've made hundreds of millions of tests available, and you can order them for free to your doorstep. And we've already ordered free tests. If you already ordered free tests tonight, I'm announcing you can order another group of tests. Go to covidtest.gov starting next week, and you can get more tests. Second, we must prepare for new variants. Over the past, we've gotten much better at detecting new variants. If necessary, we'll be able to develop new vaccines within 100 days instead of maybe months or years. And if Congress provides the funds we need, we'll have new stockpiles of tests, masks, pills ready if needed. I can't promise a new variant won't come, but I can promise you we'll do everything within our power to be ready if it does. Third, we can end the shutdown of schools and businesses. We have the tools we need. It's time for America to get back to work and fill our great downtowns again with people. People working from home can feel safe and begin to return to their offices. We're doing that here in the federal government. The vast majority of federal workers will once again work in person. Our schools are open. Let's keep it that way. Our kids need to be in school. With 75% of adult Americans fully vaccinated and hospitalizations down by 77%, most Americans can remove their masks and stay in the classroom and move forward safely. We achieved this because we provided free vaccines, treatments, tests, and masks. Of course, continuing this costs money, so I'll not surprise you. I'll be back to see y'all. And I'm going to soon send a request to Congress The vast majority of Americans have used these tools and may want again. We may need them again. So I expect Congress, and I hope you'll pass that quickly. Fourth, we'll continue vaccinating the world. We've sent 475 million vaccine doses to 112 countries, more than any nation on Earth. We won't stop. Because you can't build a wall high enough to keep out a vaccine. The vaccine can stop the spread of these diseases. You know, we've lost so much in COVID-19. Time with one another. The worst of all, the loss of life. Let's use this moment to reset. So stop looking at COVID as a partisan dividing line. See it for what it is. A god-awful disease. Let's stop seeing each other as enemies and start seeing each other for who we are, fellow Americans. Look. We can't change how divided we've been. It's a long time in coming. But we can change how to move forward on COVID-19 and other issues that we must face together. I recently visited New York City Police Department days after the funerals of Officer Wilmer Mora and his partner, Officer Jason Rivera. They were responding to a 9/11 call when a man shot and killed them with a stolen gun. Officer Mora was 27 years old. Officer Rivera was 22 years old. Both Dominican Americans who grew up in the same streets that they later chose to patrol as police officers. I spoke with their families, and I told them they were forever in debt for their sacrifices and will carry on their mission to restore the trust and safety of every community deserves. Like some of you that have been around for a while, I've worked with you on these issues for a long time. I know what works. Investigating crime prevention and community policing, cops who walk the beat, who know the neighborhood, and who can restore trust and safety. Let's not abandon our streets or choose between safety and equal justice. Let's come together and protect our communities, restore trust, and hold law enforcement accountable. That's why the Justice Department has required body cameras, banned choke calls, and restricted no-knock warrants for its officers. That's why the American Rescue Plan that you all provided $350 billion that cities, states, and counties can use to hire more police, invest in more proven strategies. Proven strategies like community violence interruption, trusted messengers, breaking the cycle of violence and trauma, and giving young people some hope. We should all agree the answer is not to defund the police. It's to fund the police. Fund them. Fund them. Fund them with resources and training. Resources and training they need to protect our communities. I ask Democrats and Republicans alike to pass my budget and keep our neighborhoods safe. And we'll do everything in my power to crack down on gun trafficking of ghost guns that you can buy online, assemble at home. No serial numbers. Can't be traced. I ask Congress to pass proven measures to reduce gun violence. Pass universal background checks. Why should anyone on the terrorist list be able to purchase a weapon? Why? Why? And folks, ban assault weapons with high-capacity magazines that hold up 100 rounds. You think the deer are wearing Kevlar vests? Look, repeal the liability shield that makes gun manufacturers the only industry in America that can't be sued. The only one. Imagine had we done that with the tobacco manufacturers. These laws don't infringe on the Second Amendment. They save lives. The most fundamental right in America is the right to vote and have it counted. And look, It's under assault. In state after state, new laws have been passed. Not only to suppress the vote, we've been there before, but to subvert the entire election. You can't let this happen. Tonight, I call on the Senate to pass the Freedom to Vote Act, pass the John Lewis Act, Voting Rights Act. And while you're at it, pass the Disclose Act so Americans know who's funding our election. Look, tonight, I'd like to honor someone who dedicated his life to serve this country. Justice Breyer, an Army veteran, constitutional scholar, retiring Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Justice Breyer, thank you for your service. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I mean it. Get up, stand, let them see you. Thank you. And we all know, no matter what your ideology, we all know one of the most serious constitutional responsibilities a president has is nominating someone to serve on the United States Supreme Court. As I did 4 days ago, I've nominated the Circuit Court of Appeals, Ketanji Brown Jackson, one of our nation's top legal minds, who continue in Justice Breyer's legacy of excellence. A former top litigator in private practice, a former federal public defender, from a family of public school educators and police officers. She's a consensus builder. Since she's been nominated, she's received a broad range of support, including the Fraternal Order of Police and former judges supported by Democrats and Republicans. Folks, if we're to advance liberty and justice, we need to secure our border and fix the immigration system. And as you might guess, I think we can do both. At our border, we've installed new technology like cutting-edge scanners to better detect drug smuggling. We've set up joint patrols with Mexico and Guatemala to catch more human traffickers. We're putting in place dedicated immigration judges in a significant larger number so families fleeing persecution and violence can have their cases heard faster and those who don't legitimately hear can be sent back. We're screening, we're securing commitments and supporting partners in South and Central America to host more refugees and secure their own borders. We can do all this while keeping lit the torch of liberty that has led the generation of immigrants to this land, my forebears and many of yours. Provide a pathway to citizenship for dreamers, those with temporary status, farm workers, essential workers. Revise our laws so businesses have workers they need. And families don't wait decades to reunite. It's not only the right thing to do, it's economically smart thing to do. That's why the immigration reform is supported by everyone from labor unions to religious leaders to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Let's get it done once and for all. Folks, advancing liberty and justice also requires protecting the rights of women. The constitutional right affirmed by Roe v. Wade, standing precedent for half a century, is under attack as never before. If you want to go forward, not backwards, we must protect access to health care, preserve a woman's right to choose, and continue to advance maternal health care for all Americans. And folks, for our LGBTQ plus Americans, let's finally get the Bipartisan Equality Act to my desk. The onslaught of state laws targeting transgender Americans and their families. It's simply wrong. And I said last year, especially to our younger transgender Americans, I'll always have your back as your president so you can be yourself and reach your God-given potential. Folks, as I've just demonstrated, while it often appears we do not agree, and that We do agree on a lot more things than we acknowledge. I signed 80 bipartisan bills into law last year, from preventing government shutdowns, to protecting aged Americans from still-too-common hate crimes, to reforming military justice, and will soon be strengthening the Violence Against Women Act that I first wrote three decades ago. It's important. It's important for us to show the nation we can come together and do big things. So tonight I'm offering a unity agenda for the nation. Four big things we can do together, in my view. First, beat the opioid epidemic. There's so much we can do. Increase funding for prevention, treatment, harm reduction and recovery. Get rid of outdated rules and stop doctors prescribing treatments. Stop the flow of illicit drugs by working with state and local law enforcement to go after the traffickers. And if you're suffering from addiction, you should know you're not alone. I believe in recovery, and I celebrate the 23 million Americans in recovery. Second, let's take on mental health, especially among our children whose lives and education have been turned upside down. The American Rescue Plan gave schools money to hire teachers and help students make up for lost learning. I urge every parent to make sure your school does just that. They have the money. We can all play a part. Sign up to be a tutor or a mentor. Children were also struggling before the pandemic, bullying, violence, trauma, and the harms of social media. As Frances Haugen, who is here tonight with us, has shown, we must hold social media platforms accountable for the national experiment they're conducting on our children for profit. Folks, thank you. Thank you for the courage you showed. It's time to strengthen privacy protections, ban targeted advertising to children, demand tech companies stop collecting personal data on our children, and let's get all Americans the mental health services they need. More people can turn for help and full parity between physical and mental health care if we treat it that way in our insurance. Look, the third piece of that agenda is support our veterans. Veterans are the backbone and the spine of this country. They're the best of us. I've always believed that we have a sacred obligation to equip those we send to war and care for those and their family when they come home. My administration is providing assistance in job training, housing, and now helping lower-income veterans get VA care debt-free. And our troops in Iraq have faced, in Afghanistan, have faced many dangers, one being stationed at bases breathing in toxic smoke from burn pits. Many of you have been there. I've been in and out of Iraq and Afghanistan over 40 times. These burn pits that incinerate waste, the waste of war, medical and hazards material, jet fuel, and so much more. And they come home, many of the world's fittest and best-trained warriors in the world, never the same. Headaches, numbness, dizziness, a cancer that would put them in a flag-draped coffin. I know. One of those soldiers was my son, Major Beau Biden. I don't know for sure if the burn pit that he lived near, that his hooch was near in Iraq and earlier than that in Kosovo, is the cause of his brain cancer, the disease of so many other troops. But I am committed to find out everything we can, committed to military families like Danielle Robinson from Ohio, the widow of Sergeant First Class Heath Robinson. He was born a soldier, Army National Guard, combat medic in Kosovo and Iraq, stationed near Baghdad just yards from burn pits the size of football fields. Danielle is here with us tonight. They love going to Ohio State football games. And they love building Legos with their daughter. But cancer from prolonged exposure to burn pits ravaged Heath's lungs and body. Danielle says Heath was a fighter to the very end. He didn't know how to stop fighting, and neither did she. Through her pain, she found purpose to demand that we do better. Tonight, Danielle, we are going to do better. The VA is pioneering new ways of linking toxic exposure to disease, already helping more veterans get benefits. And tonight, I'm announcing we're expanding eligibility to veterans suffering from 9 respiratory cancers. I'm also calling on Congress to pass a law to make sure veterans devastated by toxic exposure in Iraq and Afghanistan finally get the benefits of the comprehensive health care they deserve. And fourth and last, let's end cancer as we know it. This is personal. This is personal to me and to Jill and to Kamala and so many of you. So many of you have lost someone you love. Husband, wife, son, daughter, mom, dad. Cancer is the number 2 cause of death in America, second only to heart disease. Last month, I announced the plan to supercharge the cancer moonshot that President Obama asked me to lead 6 years ago. Our goal is to cut cancer death rates by at least 50% over the next 25 years. I think we can do better than that. Turn cancers from death sentences into treatable diseases. More support for patients and their families. To get there, I call on Congress to fund what I call ARPA-H, Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, patterned after DARPA and the Defense Department, projects that led in DARPA to the Internet, GPS, and so much more to make our forces more safer and be able to wage war more with more clarity. ARPA will have a singular purpose, to drive breakthroughs in cancer, Alzheimer's and diabetes, and more. A unity agenda for the nation. We can do these things. It's within our power. And I don't see a partisan edge to any one of those 4 things. My fellow Americans, tonight we've gathered in this sacred space, a citadel of democracy. In this Capitol, generation after generation of Americans have debated great questions amid great strife and have done great things. We fought for freedom, expanded liberty, debated totalitarianism and terror. We built the strongest, freest, and most prosperous nation the world has ever known. Now is the hour, our moment of responsibility. Our test of resolve and conscience, of history itself. It is in this moment that our character of this generation is formed. Our purpose is found. Our future is forged. Well, I know this nation. We'll meet the test, protect freedom and liberty, expand fairness and opportunity, and we will save democracy. As hard as those times have been, I'm more optimistic about America today than I've been my whole life, because I see the future that's within our grasp, because I know there's simply nothing beyond our capacity. We're the only nation on earth that has always turned every crisis we faced into an opportunity. The only nation that can be defined by a single word, possibilities. So on this night, on our 245th year as a nation, I've come to report on the state of the nation, the State of the Union. And my report is this. The State of the Union is strong because you, the American people, are strong. We are stronger today. We are stronger today than we were a year ago. And we'll be stronger a year from now than we are today. This is our moment to meet and overcome the challenges of our time. And we will, as one people, one America, the United States of America. God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you. Go get him.
We just heard President Biden's State of the Union address. Moments from now, we will hear the Republican response. Steve, what stood out for you as you listened to Biden speak?
Well, I think what was really remarkable is that the president spent, the first 10 minutes just talking about Ukraine and Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. Outside of wartime, I can't think of a time, maybe since 9/11, when so much has been devoted to something that's happening outside of the United States.
Now, clearly, President Biden wanted an image projected to the world of American unity, American resolve on Ukraine, zero daylight between Democrats and Republicans.
Absolutely.
Do you think that image and that message was projected?
Yes, but is it received in Moscow? Will they see the significance of what the president did here? Will it make any difference? Perhaps not, but definitely to the people of Ukraine, to the people of Europe, after a period where there was all sort of concerns about the United States' commitment to NATO, that's totally changed tonight.
Now, on inflation, Biden seemed to be the consoler-in-chief, the empathizer-in-chief, because in reality, there's very little a president can do to tame inflation. Going back to the 70s, Gerald Ford tried and he failed. Jimmy Carter tried and failed. Arguably, the Federal Reserve does have a tool, but nobody wants to see interest rates doubled or going up precipitously because that will strangle the economy.
Right, and I think for President Biden and the Democrats, this is the big unknown. How far does it get out of control? How big of a political impact it has? What we're seeing is inflation rising and the president's popularity declining.
Now, a presidential speech can frame a debate, perhaps move the needle of public opinion, but it can't change basic math. And the math for Democrats in Congress, even though they control both chambers, is really challenging when it comes to Build Back Better, lowering prescription drug prices, tackling climate change, immigration reform, you name it.
Certainly. And again, this was a moment for the president to rally the Democrats, to try to reach beyond his base, for those who might have tuned in to hate watch the president, to say, well, you know, maybe he's not such a bad guy, and maybe I can, empathize with what he's trying to do and what he's saying. But the polls indicate that's a very small sliver of the American voting population these days.
Opposition party responses when it comes to the State of the Union, they're often delivered by a lawmaker, and in Congress, there are several Republicans who have presidential ambitions themselves. They might have loved an opportunity to shine in the spotlight. Yet the party tapped Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, a relatively unknown figure for the Republican response.
She was relatively unknown until she ended up as governor of Iowa when her predecessor was named U.S. ambassador to China. But perhaps Reynolds is really a compromise choice so that there aren't any hurt feelings among those potential 2024 presidential contenders.
Was there anything else that caught your eye in the president's address tonight? Oh, I know that he spent a great deal of time, as you mentioned, the first 10 minutes on Ukraine, but then he pivoted quite quickly to domestic affairs and some bread and butter issues.
Certainly, and that's what these speeches more and more in recent decades have turned out to be. I thought there were some significant statements about the pandemic. the president saying that we need to stop looking at it as a partisan dividing line and see it for what it is, what he called a god-awful disease, and that people in this country need to stop seeing each other as enemies and start seeing each other for who we are, as he said, fellow Americans. He warned COVID, you know, isn't going away, but we're definitely turning the page on this pandemic. And that was evident from looking at everyone in there tonight, huddled together and without masks.
Now, President Biden spent 36 years in the Senate. He campaigned as someone who knew how to work Congress, find consensus, get things done. Yet as president, he's often had a tough go of it with lawmakers, including a few in his very own party who were here tonight.
Certainly. Well, the Democrats as a party, as we like to say, they're a big tent. And there is jostling and more that goes on inside that tent from time to time. And you have a number of lawmakers, some who think that the president is too liberal on some of these policies, especially Build Back Better, notably Joe Manchin. The only Democrat, I think, elected statewide in West Virginia. And then you have some very liberal and young members of Congress who were derided by former President Donald Trump during his time in office as the Squad, who, and Bernie Sanders, of course, Democratic Socialist Wing, who really see the president's domestic agenda as not going far enough in not only providing a safety net for Americans, but doling out more government money to help people across the country. But I think the majority of Democrats say, wow, you know, what was in this plan, the pandemic recovery and Build Back Better, was really a lot of government money going out to the rest of the country for everything from COVID testing to better broadband.
And of course, efforts to tackle
climate change, another change. Huge part of this president's agenda. We heard a bit about that. I would have expected, if it wasn't for the Ukraine crisis, we would have heard a lot more about climate change, because we just had a very big report come out a couple of days ago with very dire warnings and saying a lot's happening right now.
Now, we are coming up on midterm elections in November. Did you see anything in this speech that sort of set the mark as far as a president wanting to set the stage for the debates that will come? The Democrats do control both houses of Congress, but in the Senate, it's by a razor-thin margin, and it's not a huge margin in the House of Representatives either.
Right. Yeah, Michael, as you know, this will be known as what's called a midterm election, and generally the party that's in power in these midterm elections do not do well. So there are sort of low expectations for the Democrats, and we're at the beginning of March, the election's in early November, so they have 8 months to really convince the American public to keep them in power. And even the Democratic Party analysts and supporters that I talked to are acknowledging this is really going to be an uphill struggle.
Yes. There is a 50-50 split in the Senate. Democrats have a majority in the Senate only thanks to the vote cast by Vice President Harris, who serves as president of the Senate. Democrats did have a bigger buffer in the House of Representatives before the previous election. They did lose some seats while at the same time capturing the presidency. There is no room in terms of if they lose just one seat net in the Senate, then the Senate goes to the Republicans.
Right. And just how precarious that is, we had a reminder of that when a Democrat senator from the state of New Mexico had a stroke recently. And so and you look at the ages of some of these senators from both parties, and it's always something that would things this close would make you really nervous on whichever party you're in.
President Biden took a moment to speak on a very painful matter for him. It sort of opened up his heart out on the podium, and that, of course, is regarding the death of his son, Beau Biden, who succumbed to cancer. I don't know that I've seen a personal moment a president reveal that from the podium at a State of the Union address, at least not in my memory.
It's something he has done frequently in other speeches on the campaign trail. This is still a very painful loss for this president, and he chokes up frequently talking about his son, a son that a lot of people thought maybe had a tremendous political future. And the death of Beau Biden, really gave the president pause about continuing his own political career.
As I look at the TV monitor, I see President Biden still on the floor of the House of Representatives, shaking hands, meeting with all the different lawmakers, having a few one-on-one conversations. He seems to be in his element. He seems to be enjoying this.
Absolutely. It's now here in Washington, D.C., 10:21 p.m. He may not get back to the White House till after midnight.
As we look ahead, as we mentioned, Governor Kim Reynolds of Iowa will be giving the Republican response. Iowa is a small state in the U.S. heartland. It is perhaps best known, at least in terms of the political calendar, as the state that goes first when parties pick their presidential candidates in the nomination process.
Right. And so that could be a reason that we are seeing the governor of that state prominent tonight. The potential candidates for president probably need Kim Reynolds a lot more than she needs, certain senators in Washington, D.C. who have higher political aspirations. And as we mentioned before the State of the Union, she is obviously there to give a message, to try to counter, to push back on what the president said, especially on his domestic agenda. She's going to say that the president's taking the country in the wrong direction, in the wrong back in time. And but I think, according to an advanced text that I saw some excerpts, she is going to strike a note of unity on Ukraine. So, and that has been remarkable that in recent days we really have seen the Republicans and Democrats in the Congress align on this subject.
If anything, there seems to be a bidding war between the parties as to just how tough America should get.
Right, and there's pressure on the president to do even more. He did announce something significant tonight. I wouldn't call it a no-fly zone, but no Russian aircraft will be allowed to fly over or into the United States now. But there is pressure about this no-fly zone for Ukraine, which the Ukrainians want, and also some in the U.S. Congress want, which a lot of military experts say is problematic because how do you enforce it? And if we shoot down, the United States or a NATO ally shoots down a Russian aircraft over Ukraine, is that the beginning of a new global conflict that takes this war much beyond just Ukraine?
The State of the Union is an annual event, except for a president's very first year in office. Then it is simply a message to Congress. There's always a great amount of attention and focus in the moment. I don't know that when you look back months later or years later, that this speech has sort of an indelible impact that any president might want it to have.
By the next afternoon, sometimes they do not have any impact. I think what's going to be different this time is the war between Russia and Ukraine, and that the sound bites that the president uttered tonight about Ukraine are quotes that will be in the history books in the future.
So this one will stand out in the history books. Anything else that stood out for you in the president's speech?
Well, I thought that, as someone who has watched the president very carefully, both on the campaign trail and at the White House and out on trips, the president has had some difficulties with public speaking, mangling sentences. He's not the first president to do that, as we know, but also sometimes coughing a lot. I think I only heard him cough once tonight for a speech that was how long?
Almost an hour exactly.
Yeah. That was a pretty remarkable. So, there will be some television news commentary programs that will pick certain excerpts to portray that the president fumbled and stumbled around. But I think it was definitely one of the better speeches that I have seen Biden make. And it's not an easy speech to make because you have to cover so much territory and all of these frequent applause lines, which, of course, the president wants. But it does interrupt your rhythm. And to go back and find your place and complete your sentences, it is a challenge, even for someone like Joe Biden, who has given so many public speeches. But this was his first State of the Union, and that is something different. And I'm sure even someone as veteran as Joe Biden in front of a microphone had to be a little nervous about getting up there tonight, especially with so much at stake right now, not only the economy, but the fate of Ukraine.
Now, I imagine that presidential speechwriters and that team of speechwriters gets cracking on a State of the Union speech weeks in advance, perhaps a month in advance, I don't know, but significantly in advance.
Right.
I imagine that this is a speech that might have had revisions, at least for the top 20% of it, right up to today.
Oh, I'm sure that the revisions were being made until the last hours. I can also tell you, I was following along with the advanced text that we were provided with, Michael, and the president was making changes as he spoke as well. Not as much ad lib, of course. Donald Trump, you would have to say, in some ways, was a great ad libber. I think somewhat to the frustration of his speechwriters a lot of the time. You had other presidents who were more orthodox in sticking to the script, felt uncomfortable sort of going off script. But it wasn't, there were some paragraphs where he did ad lib, especially in the personal reminiscences and things like that. But he was revising the speech as he read it. I can tell you that.
Looking out into the House chamber while he spoke, I saw practically everyone waving small Ukrainian flags. The Ukrainian right. ambassador was present for this speech, was recognized and given a hearty ovation. Clearly, one of the intended targets in terms of the international audience is the people of Ukraine and wanting to provide a boost and sort of moral support. I'm thinking that another possible intended target might be Vladimir Putin.
Oh, absolutely. I can't say for certain 100%, but there probably has not been another State of the Union where members of the audience were waving flags of a foreign country throughout the speech. So that is something remarkable. Whoever came up with that idea, you know, should probably be deemed some sort of public relations genius as far as messaging not only into Ukraine, but also into Russia as well. Now, a big question will be is, you know, how many people in Russia actually see that? And now the Voice of America and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty have their television broadcasts. We know that more and more of the media has come under pressure in Russia in recent days. But a lot of people do have access to the internet. It's a lot less restrictive than in a country like China, for example. So this is one thing that Russia does have difficult controlling, is the images that are getting in, not only from Ukraine right now, but also from the U.S. Capitol, and showing how the rest of the world, and especially the United States, is responding. And that is probably why, Michael, that the president spent those 10 minutes at the top of this State of the Union address on Ukraine, that it was as much directed, as you said, to Vladimir Putin and the people of Russia and the people of Ukraine, as it was to what is the traditional audience for these speeches, which is the people of the United States. And, you know, we can also mention about how this speech has changed and evolved over the years. And we've talked a little bit about why. And the president mentioned at the very end that this is in the U.S. Constitution, that from time to time the president will give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. But it was known as the annual message from 1790 to 1946, and only informally was called the State of the Union from 1942 to 1946, which was wartime, of course, Franklin Roosevelt being president, World War II. But then 1947, when Harry Truman, who succeeded FDR when he died in office, then it officially became known as the State of the Union address. And let's face it, it wasn't a big deal to most Americans until early in the 20th century, because there was no radio or television. And it was in 1923 where there was the first radio broadcast of the message by President Calvin Coolidge. The first TV broadcast was that one in 1947 by President Truman. But what we're talking about, what we saw today, this evening primetime address, that did not happen until 1965 when Lyndon Johnson gave his State of the Union address. And they also can very much average in length. George Washington's,
I believe.
Here we go.
Here we go with Kim Reynolds providing the Republican response.
Good evening. I'm Kim Reynolds, governor of the great state of Iowa. Like you, I just watched the president's address. I listened as the governor of our state, as a mom and a grandmother of 11, who's worried our country is on the wrong track. We're now 1 year into his presidency, and instead of moving America forward, it feels like President Biden and his party have sent us back in time, to the late 70s and early 80s, when runaway inflation was hammering families, a violent crime wave was crashing our cities, and the Soviet Army was trying to redraw the world map. Even before taking the oath of office, the president told us that he wanted to, quote, make America respected around the world again, and to unite us here at home. He's failed on both fronts. The disastrous Afghanistan withdrawal did more than cost American lives. It betrayed our allies and emboldened our enemies. North Korea is testing missiles again at an alarming rate. The Speaker of the House recently warned our Olympic athletes not to speak out against China. And now Russia has launched an unprovoked, full-scale military invasion of Ukraine, an attack on democracy, freedom, and the rule of law. Now all Americans must stand united in solidarity with the brave people of Ukraine as they courageously defend their country against Putin's tyranny, as they fight for their freedom. But we shouldn't ignore what happened in the run-up to Putin's invasion, waiving sanctions on Russian pipelines while eliminating oil production here at home, focusing on political correctness rather than military readiness, reacting to world events instead of driving them. Weakness on the world stage has a cost, and the president's approach to foreign policy has consistently been too little, too late. It's time for America to once again project confidence It's time to be decisive. It's time to lead. But we can't project strength abroad if we're weak at home. And that's what I want to discuss with you tonight. The President and Democrats in Congress have spent the last year either ignoring the issues facing Americans or making them worse. They were warned that spending trillions would lead to soaring inflation. They were told that their anti-energy policies would send gas prices to new heights. But they plowed ahead anyway, raising the price at the pump by 50% and pushing inflation to a 40-year high. 4 decades ago, when our nation was last reeling from inflation, I was a young working mom just starting out. My husband, Kevin, worked days while I watched our girls, and then we would literally switch. We would pass in the yard as he was coming home, and I was leaving to work evenings at the local grocery store. From across that checkout counter, I saw the pain of inflation on my neighbors' faces. I saw what happens when prices rise faster than wages. The Biden administration believes inflation is a, quote, high-class problem. I can tell you, it's an everybody problem. I saw moms' and dads' paychecks buy them less and less. I watched working people choose which essentials to take home and which ones to leave behind. And now President Biden's decisions have a whole new generation feeling that same pain. When I took the oath of office 5 years ago, I promised Iowans that I would never lose sight of who I was working for, that I wouldn't become detached from the problems they were facing, from the problems that I had faced myself. But you don't have to check groceries to see what high inflation does to people. You just need to step outside of the DC bubble. Talk to Americans about what's on their mind. Ask them, what are your concerns? What keeps you up at night? And they'll tell you. And I can tell you what's not on that list. They won't tell you that spending trillions more and bankrupting their children is the answer to their problems. They won't tell you that we should be paying people not to work. And they certainly won't tell you that we should give billions in tax giveaways to millionaires and billionaires in Democrat-controlled states like California, New York, and New Jersey. But that's what the Biden administration has been pushing for over the last year. And that's all part of Build Back Better. Thankfully, the president's agenda didn't pass because even members of his own party said enough is enough. Well, the American people share that view. Enough is enough. And it's not just with DC spending. Americans are tired of a political class trying to remake this country into a place where an elite few tell everyone else what they can and cannot say, what they can and cannot believe. They're tired of people pretending the way to end racism is by categorizing everybody by their race. They're tired of politicians who tell parents they should sit down, be silent, and let government control their kids' education and future. Frankly, they are tired of the theater, where politicians do one thing when the cameras are rolling and another when they believe you can't see them, where governors and mayors enforce mandates but don't follow them, where elected leaders tell their citizens to stay home while they sneak off to Florida for sun and fun, where they demand that your child wear a mask, but they go maskless. So you've heard the excuses. They were just holding their breath. But it's the American people who are waiting to exhale, waiting for the insanity to stop. We now live in a country where violent crime is out of control. Liberal prosecutors are letting criminals off easy, and many prominent Democrats still want to defund the police. You know, it seems like everything is backwards. The Biden administration requires vaccines for Americans who want to go to work or protect this country, but not for migrants who illegally cross the border. The Department of Justice treats parents like domestic terrorists, but looters and shoplifters roam free. the American people are left to feel like they're the enemy. This is not the same country it was a year ago. The president tried to paint a different picture tonight, but his actions over the last 12 months don't match the rhetoric. It's not what he promised when he took office. But it doesn't have to be that way. There is an alternative. Across the nation, Republican governors and legislators are showing Americans what conservative leadership looks like, what it means to respect the people we serve, to hear them out, to stand up for them and walk alongside them. We know that our problems require bold action, but we also know that bold action doesn't have to mean government action. It's Americans making their own decisions for their own families and future. Republican governors faced the same COVID-19 virus head-on. But we honored your freedoms and saw right away that lockdowns and school closures, they came with their own significant cost, that mandates weren't the answer. And we actually listened to the science, especially with kids in masks and kids in schools. What happened and is still happening to our children over the last 2 years is unconscionable. Learning loss, isolation, anxiety, depression. In so many states, our kids have been left behind, and so many will never catch up. That's why Iowa was the first state in the nation to require that schools open their doors. I was attacked by the left. I was attacked by the media. But it wasn't a hard choice. It was the right choice. And keeping schools open is only the start of the pro-parent, pro-family revolution that Republicans are leading in Iowa and states across this country. Republicans believe that parents matter. It was true before the pandemic, and it has never been more important to say out loud. Parents matter. They have a right to know and to have a say in what their kids are being taught. Families also have every right to live in a safe and a secure community. And that begins with a safe and secure country. But the Biden administration has refused to secure our border. They've refused to provide the resources to stop human trafficking, to stop the staggering influx of deadly drugs coming into our neighborhoods. They've refused to protect you. With Texas and Arizona leading the way, I, along with Republican governors from several states, have sent resources to the border. And we've actually gone to the border, something that our president and vice president have yet to do since taking office. On the economy, the contrast couldn't be more stark. While Democrats in D.C. are spending trillions, sending inflation soaring, Republican leaders around the country are balancing budgets and cutting taxes, because we know that money spent on Main Street is better than money spent on bureaucracy. Today, I signed legislation that eliminates Iowa's tax on retirement income and sets our tax rate at 3.9%. That's less than half of what it was just 4 years ago. And it shouldn't come as a surprise that out of the top 20 states with the lowest unemployment rates, 17 have Republican governors. Republicans may not have the White House, but we're doing what we can to fill the leadership vacuum. And on the issues that are affecting Americans, Republicans are leading. We're standing up for parents and kids. We're standing up for life. We're keeping our communities safe and thanking those in uniform. We're fighting to restore America's energy independence, and that includes biofuels. We're getting people back to work, not paying them to stay home. Most of all, we're respecting your freedom. Behind me stands Iowa's Capitol, where we display our state motto, "Our liberties we prize and our rights we will maintain." And those aren't just empty words. It's a belief that the greatness of this state and this country lies in our people, not government. You shouldn't have to wake up every morning and worry about the next thing the government is going to do to you, your business, or your children. If we as elected leaders are doing our job, then the government is working well, but operating in the background. It's supporting the ingenuity and spirit of our people, not drowning them out. It's keeping them safe, not restricting their freedom. That's what I believe, that's what Republicans believe, and that's what Republicans are doing. I am so blessed to be the governor of Iowa, where people are humble, hardworking, and patriotic. We take care of each other. And yes, we are, as they say, Iowa nice. But you don't have to be from Iowa to see that those are the values of America at its best, all of America. Over the last few years, I've put my faith in Iowans, and they haven't let me down. I encourage this president to do the same, to put his faith in you, the American people, who have never wavered in your belief in this country, regardless of who leads it. Because you know, you've shown that the soul of America isn't about who lives in the White House. It's men and women like you in every corner of this nation who are willing to step up and take responsibility for your communities, for your neighbors, and ultimately for yourselves. By that most important measure at least, the state of our union is indeed strong. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless the United States of America.
And we just heard Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds deliver the Republican response to President Joe Biden's State of the Union address. Clearly, the governor drew some sharp contrasts compared to what President Biden spoke about on issue after issue. What stood out for you?
Well, it was a very traditional Republican speech, at least some of the talking points. I wrote down more Ronald Reagan than Donald Trump, and I think this was music to the ears of Mitch McConnell, especially, where she derided big government spending, the government controlling everything. However, I think a couple of things that she talked about that Biden sort of preempted her about defund the police and being weak on the border, because Biden very clearly stated that we should not defund the police. And he talked about tough action on the border and with immigration. A couple of things that she did mention that the president did not talk about: Afghanistan and North Korea. And, of course, the opposition message is always trying to paint the president as being a weak leader and taking the country in the wrong direction. And we certainly heard that from Kim Reynolds. But obviously, this was a very domestic message, unlike the president's first 10 minutes of his speech, which was meant for an international audience, especially in Eastern Europe, as much as anywhere else. This was to try to give some of that wholesomeness of the Midwest, of Iowa, to the rest of the country, and perhaps reach out to some Democrat voters who might be disillusioned by what's happening now and saying, hey, come over it to our tent. You know, we do stand for your values as well, especially those more conservative elements of personal liberties and not having the government tell parents what to do in the schools.
So perhaps a return to more traditional Republican messaging: smaller government, individual choice, lower taxes. These weren't things that we heard emphasized all that often by former President Trump.
Right. The party during the Trump era was the Trump Party, not the Republican Party. I think it's very fair to say that. Now, There are a lot of Republicans who, especially on policy, want to take things back to a more traditional direction, especially in a midterm election year. But looking ahead to 2024, the next presidential election, you can tell the audience who is the top choice right now of Republican voters when they're surveyed in this country, and that's Donald Trump. So I think we may see a very subtle battle in the months ahead between people such as Mitch McConnell, Senator McConnell, who is the top Republican in the U.S. Senate, and then Donald Trump looming over the party, making endorsements and getting out on the campaign trail. So Kim Reynolds, of course, a sort of softer, gentler image of the Republican Party that they had an opportunity to trot out tonight for a very big audience.
Just outside of Washington, D.C. is the state of Virginia, which recently elected a Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, who led a campaign that was heavily focused on the question of the rights of parents to be involved in schools. And that message carried the day in Virginia. He was elected governor. And I heard a lot of the same messaging from Kim Reynolds in the Republican response. Perhaps this is sort of a taste of Republican messaging to come.
The Republicans are certainly hoping what happened in Virginia spreads like wildfire across the country. But I've spoken to some Democratic Party strategists about that race, and their contention is, as much as anything, was the party and the Democratic candidate, who was someone who wanted to return to the governorship, took that race too much for granted. And this upstart outsider who was very well financed, by the way, we should say. And also what I noticed watching television in the market in this part of the country, Glenn Youngkin had his commercials out there for months without any answer from the Democrats on that. So, definitely out of the population centers of the state of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin was by far the most popular candidate, and he ate away just enough into the traditionally blue counties of the state to take that race. So it remains to be seen. We have a big race coming up later this year in Texas for governor, and that would be a real prize if the Democrats were able to steal that one away from the Republicans, because Texas is a big red state, we should say.
You mentioned that President Biden had nothing to say in his State of the Union address on North Korea, glossed over Afghanistan and the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops last year. Similarly, however, Kim Reynolds glossed over the entire question of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Was a surprise. I would have expected to have heard, much more emphasis on a message of a unity from her in those remarks. But again, you can't get everything in either the State of the Union or the opposition party's rebuttal. And you've got to decide, what are we really trying to accomplish here tonight? As I've said before, State of the Union is like a weird buffet dinner. You have 100 items presented to you, but you're only getting small bites of each of the items. So you leave perhaps bloated and needing an antacid, but you didn't get to really dig in with your knife and fork into maybe your favorite dishes too much.
Well, on that note, Steve, thank you for joining me for the State of the Union. And we heard tonight President Biden's State of the Union address and the Republican response. And we now go to International Edition in Progress. Similar moves.
Japan has been especially loud in condemning Russia. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said he told Ukraine's president he stands with Ukraine and offered unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. The anti-Russia sentiment is far from unanimous in Asia. Most prominently, China and North Korea have defended Russia, saying the root cause of the conflict lies with the United States. In Southeast Asia, most governments have remained silent. Last week, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, released a statement on Ukraine that refrained from describing Russia's actions as an invasion. In fact, the statement did not mention Russia at all. Lim says that's because many countries there have strong economic and military ties with Russia, stretching back to the Cold War.
In ASEAN, some of them have very close, traditional, long relationships with Russia, so they will be a bit more cautious. So in this sense, voices of U.S. allies like Japan and South Korea and strategic partners like Singapore are perhaps more at the forefront of the moves like sanctions on Russia.
But even among U.S. allies, the Ukraine situation could be altering ties with Russia. Both South Korea and Japan had pursued better relations with Moscow. Those efforts now seem in jeopardy. Russia's ambassador to Seoul this week said South Korea-Russia ties had improved for 30 years. Now, he said, things seem to have changed course. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
In other news, the World Bank on Tuesday approved a plan to use more than $1 billion from a frozen Afghanistan trust fund to finance education, agriculture, health, and family programs. The plan bypasses sanctioned Taliban authorities by dispersing the money through the United Nations agencies and international aid groups and will provide a major boost to efforts to ease the country's humanitarian and economic crisis. The Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund was frozen in August when the Taliban overran Kabul as U.S.-led international troops departed after 20 years of war. Foreign governments ended financial aid, which had funded most of the government spending, and the United States froze billions of dollars of Afghan funds, accelerating an economic collapse, and that the U.N. says has pushed half the population into severe hunger. What is happening inside Chinese authorities' facilities that Beijing calls vocational education and training centers? Well, reports from those who were confined in these detention camps and drone footage help paint a picture of life behind these walls. Survivors say Uyghurs and other religious and ethnic minorities in China are being persecuted for their religions and cultures. For VOA, Sanja Komedov has more from survivors who fled to the U.S. Anne Rice narrates this story.
This is a graphic novella that tells a story of genocide against Uyghur Muslims in China. It was drawn by 33-year-old Uyghur Mihri Gultursun, based on her 2015 experience in a Chinese camp. The novella was published on the Share American website, a U.S. State Department platform used to share U.S. foreign policy information around the world. Tursun says she was separated from her newborn triplets when she entered the detention camp, where she remained for the next 3 years. She says during that time, one of her children died of starvation.
My life is destroyed from 2015 to until 2018. From 2015 until 2018, I have get torture physically and the psychological torture in prison. I have electric and I witnessed nine women die in the prison.
40-year-old Zumra Dawood spent 2 months in a detention camp. During that time, Chinese doctors used unknown medication on her. She says as a result, she and her husband can't have children.
And in these 62 days, it's 2 months, what I have experienced was several things. One of them was being forced to take medications. I don't know what medications we were taking, but they gave us medications and even checked our mouths with their fingers to make sure we swallowed what they gave us.
When she fled to the U.S., she says doctors in America told her she had undergone sterilization and could no longer have children. 60-year-old Abdullahat Noor, also Uyghur, now lives in Canada. He says he fled to Kazakhstan after Chinese authorities demanded that he pay for his third year in a camp. Chinese police tracked him down.
Kyrgyzstan, even Uzbekistan or Kazakhstan, Chinese intelligence service coming there.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great day ahead.